Welcome to Dolly Reads for You with Dolly Howard, a production of Cosmic Reality Radio. And you were live when you were singing. I just turned off the mic.
Well, you told me you were going to mute me.
Well, I did, but then I was unmuting you so that you'd be ready to talk, and you got a lovely voice.
I always sing. I love that song, Sail Away, Sail Away, Sail Away. Yeah, I like it, so I sing along to it. Oh, boy. Oh, I'm live. Okay. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. This is some day in the universe.
March 13th.
Yeah, well, that sounds like a good date to me. And it's Wednesday because I'm doing Durfee. I'm a little bit spacey today. I'll warn you ahead of time. But I've been enjoying the spaciness, so it's a fun spacey today. You're listening to Dolly Reads for You. And I'm reading Real Encounters, Different Dimensions, and Otherworldly Beings, written by Brad and Sherry Steiger. And so far, we're only into page... Which page am I on? Okay. We're only into page 64, but I've been thoroughly enjoying this book. Thoroughly. I really appreciate that the books are picked out, not by me, but I go to the store and they're either knocked out of the bookshelf at me or they fall down in front of me on the shelf or hi, happy listener. I see you. Hi. These books are picked out by spirits because they know what you all want me to be reading. Well, maybe not all of you, but a lot of you want me to be reading at this time. So the books are specially picked out for you by the spirits. I was listening to the tapes. I like to listen to YouTube videos, and I like to listen to the current dates, YouTubes. But I was listening to one from yesterday, and it was saying how Nancy Pelosi doesn't want to go after Trump impeachment anymore. She says it's just not worth it. You know, she's kind of... Either she's got something up her sleeve, or somebody has gotten to her. White hat, black hat, I don't know. In some blackmail stuff there, and they got her right where they want her. I'd say right by the gonads, but she's female, so I don't know how to say that. But anyway, she really looked defeated when she said it, and sounded defeated, but... I don't trust her, so I don't know if she's got something up her sleeve or some other kind of nasty-ass things that she wants to do or what. But I was kind of glad to see that they're going to finally let that go. So anyway, I just had to share that with you, my happiness over that. I'm going to be taking a break every half hour today, y'all, so that I can get through this and be able to breathe better than what I can if I just go a straight hour. I just want to warn you ahead of time. So, there was something I wanted to share with Nancy, and I can't remember it, but when I do, I'll tell her. And y'all can hear it too. Let's see. Oh, Mona, I wanted to say thank you to you for what you said yesterday when we were doing Nancy and Walton and I were doing the show. It was Oh, you said that I didn't need an intervention, and I really, really appreciate your support on that for me, Mona. I wanted to tell you that yesterday, but things got rather, we were having a good time yesterday, a good show, so I didn't be able to get that part in. I typed a note to myself so I'd remember, though. So I just want to say thank you so much, Mona. I appreciate that support. Okay, now back to the book. We have this. I'm going to start with a section titled "An Alien Told Lila He Is Her True Father." Wait a minute, who's Lila? I got lost. You know, I skipped a week last week because I really wasn't feeling so good. But I'm better because we figured out what the issue was. Doctor's right on it. So now I forgot who is Lila. Do we all remember who's Lila? I don't know. I'm looking. Nope, I don't remember. Maybe we'll figure it out. So, Lila said that she no longer has any doubts regarding the identity of her real father. Lila, oh, here he's going to tell us, 22 years old when she filed a report with us, stated that she has been communicating telepathically with an alien being that she calls father, an entity who says he is her true male parent. As it appears to be with so many individuals who have such memories, Lila was an unexpected child, and now her father has awakened her to the knowledge of who her real parents are and where her home planet is. Lila says that she cannot wait to go home. The alien being who identifies itself as her father also states that Joyce, Lila's two-year-old daughter, is his granddaughter. Well, that's special. I always think that, too. Lila says that she cannot wait to go home. Me, too. Well, I can wait, but I'm anxious to go home. Excited to go home. Looking forward to it. New section called Declared Sterile. She might have been impregnated by an alien. Teresa was a 27-year-old accountant when she wrote to us that it was not until she had been out on her own, away from her family home for 3 or 4 years, that her mother told her the following story. Teresa's mother had been declared sterile, and in spite of repeated attempts to become pregnant, it was to no avail. The doctors had begun to suggest adoption, and Teresa's parents were strongly considering this option. Then, Teresa's mother, according to her story, was awakened one night by a strange buzzing sound that she described as sounding something like a metallic bumblebee. She looked up from the bed to see a bright light about the size of a soccer ball moving across the bedroom. Before she could say anything to her sleeping husband, before she could shout or scream or express alarm or fear, she felt herself entering an altered state of consciousness. Dimly, she remembered the light hovering above her husband. At that point, her husband, although he was asleep, became animated as if he were a marionette being pulled into sudden life. And although her husband never opened his eyes, he performed the act of love with her. And it was roughly 9 months after that strange act of cosmic sex that Teresa was born. Her mother told Teresa that on the way home from the hospital, she became aware of a bright light in the sky above the automobile. Woo-hoo, wow! As she walked into the house with baby Teresa in her arms, the light seemed to hover at treetop level. The light, according to her mother, was witnessed by several neighbors and by Teresa's father. After hovering at treetop level for 10 or 15 minutes, it moved into the night sky at an enormous rate of speed. After hearing her mother's peculiar story, Teresa said that she felt a little uneasy about exactly who her true father might be. She admitted that ever since she had been a small child, she had a fascination for outer space and UFOs. It was during such a discussion of various science fiction and science concepts, including the possibility that extraterrestrial visitations could be occurring, that Teresa's mother had told her the strange account of her conception and birth. New section called Are Starseed and Space Kids Accelerating Human Evolution? In a discussion with Dr. Andrija, A-N-D-R-I-J-A, Puharich, P-U-H-A-R-I-C-H, and his associates about the reality of those who claim to be starseed, the space kids, awakening among us to accelerate human evolution, he commented. And here's his commenting. I think it's a phenomenon that will eventually become clear, but it's not going to become clear with the ordinary three-dimensional vision that we exercise in contemporary science. I think we're going to have to develop what I call a whole race of psychonauts, talented people who are able to cross dimensional barriers. And there are such people. I've worked with them. They can see into the future. They can see into the next dimension. They can bring back reliable, hard information that can be verified in the three-dimensional world. I think it's going to take an enormous amount of data collection with these psychonauts who can escape from the fourth dimension and the fifth dimension and the sixth dimension and tap other civilizations, get aboard spacecraft physically, be teletransported from here to some other civilization. I think we're just at the beginning of a whole new age of exploration. And to me, it's probably much more exciting than the time when the first little old Neanderthal man dug out a canoe and sailed forth. That little Neanderthal and his canoe led to the great age of exploration. But the exploration on which we are now embarking will be much greater than landing on the moon or going to Jupiter. I think that everybody should be aware that we are dealing with exciting new phenomenon, which will make the present way of life seem archaic and primitive. As we look at man in the Paleolithic age, I think we are on the threshold, and we have all the tools, all the opportunities. All we have to do is remain cool about it and not try to preserve old ideas, old systems, old philosophies of science, old religions, old political forms, which I think the political forms are really getting blown up. I sure hope so. I think we should imagine that the world never existed before, and we're starting out from scratch. We've got the opportunity to create a whole new world. I'm looking at this picture in the book, and it's very very disturbing to me what I'm looking at, and I can't even describe it because it's that disturbing. I wish you could see it, but I don't know how to get it to you. It says, are we heading toward a new era for humankind when we are all transformed in a very deep and spiritual way? And it's got the picture of the earth, and then up on the side top of the earth is this, it's like a figure of a being with a heart in the middle of the chest with some kind of circle in the, where the heart comes down on the top. And then in the genitalia area, it's got, I can't even describe it. Looks like it has testicles. And I can't describe the other area. I really can't. And then there's a rope coming around the top of the thighs and going down on the inside of the legs. So maybe it's trying to show us male-female type entity. I'm not sure. Strange picture. I wish I could show it to you. The new section. The coming transformation of humankind. One of Dr. P's associates, John Whitmore, said that the big picture is a transformation of humankind. This comes in so many different forms. Even sociologists are writing about some sort of a transformation. I think each group perceives it in the context in which they're working. I think that too few people are drawing connections between all these things. We have been conditioned to the specialized, focused ways of perception. I think the new age, so to speak, is a holistic age. Melanie Toyofuku, also in attendance at our group discussion, agreed that both a biological and a spiritual evolution is occurring right now. I agree with that completely. In Queen Victoria's time, for example, some women began menstruating at the age of 21. Today, girls are menstruating at the young age of 10. I think that a kind of biological evolution makes it a lot easier for people to accept a psychological and a spiritual evolution. And the children are in that kind of evolution. The children have evolved to the point where they're transcending. All that's happening in transcendence, all that's happening in transcendence. I think that transcendence is the important thing. Some people transcend on a religious level. They commune with God, and that's enough for them. You mention space civilizations to them, and they get very upset. With the space children, religion upsets them. They're in another kind of space with another civilization. All of that, to me, is comfortable. I think the arguments we create, whether it's a UFO, whether it's a Jungian thought form, whether it's collective unconscious, all that is less important to me in terms of an argument. All of it is totally acceptable to me, and I think it depends upon your personal belief system as to whichever cosmology you wish to believe. The important thing is that if we are indeed here as part of the evolutionary process, which I believe we are, then our commitment is to be effective in creating a transcended planet so that we survive in light and be the best that man can be. It's the end of that chapter. So as I'm reading about that, this transcended stuff, I keep going back to our conversation last night when I was sharing with everyone. I learned that there's a new category of people now that like to call themselves they, T-H-E-Y, because they think they're both male and female. So I'm wondering, okay, is this part of this transcendation that this person is talking about, this Dr. P? I don't know. I need a drink, though. I know that. It seems like every day lately my mind is blown with some new information, whether I can take it or not. New chapter is titled Sky Critters and Orbs. Here's an introduction to it. In the mid-1960s, when Brad Steiger left teaching to explore full-time the strange, the unusual, and the unknown, and when his writings had received national attention because of a number of best-selling books, he still found it rather difficult to come out of the cosmic closet in his native Iowa, the buckle in America's Bible Belt. At that time, Fay Clark, the author of Beyond the Light and publisher of Hiawatha Books, Hiawatha, Iowa, became an early supporter and mentor of Brad's. It seemed that Fay, who had close ties with the Association for Research and Enlightenment, also known as ARE, also knew many key members in the psychic, paranormal, and UFO fields from coast to coast. Clark opened many doors for Brad, and he also opened corners of Brad's mind that might have remained shut far longer if not for his guidance and inspiration. It seemed as though whenever Brad lectured in those early days, there was Fay, his wife Mary, and two Methodist pastors, Reverend Milton Northurft, Northurft, and Reverend Mark Weston, members of the Spiritual Frontiers Fellowship, an organization also very supportive of Brad's early work. An extra bonus for movie buff Brad was that Fay was an absolute dead ringer for the great motion picture actor Claude Rains. Even to his manner of speaking, sometimes Brad truly felt as though he was receiving instruction from the invisible man, Sir John Talbot, or Mr. Jordan. Here is a remarkable account from Fay, who died on October 23, 1991, telling in his own words about his sighting of what he believed to be a living UFO circa 1973. Hi, Aquarius. How was your day, honey? New section. Sighting a living UFO. This is going to be interesting. I can't figure what's a living UFO. By Fay Clark. I had been investigating UFOs for 22 years, but the sighting that completely changed my view of the phenomenon occurred at Lone Pine, California. My wife and I observed a UFO resting on a small grove of aspen trees. We had been attracted to the area by a terrifically bright light that was so intense we were unable to look directly at it. Then the light subsided somewhat and we could see the clear outline of the object. All the way around it were openings in its sides. The light began to grow until it covered nearly the entire area of the object. As it grew in size, it lost its brilliance and became a lavender color. When the light reached nearly the entire size of the object, the illumination began to shrink down until it got to the very brilliant white portion again, which, if my judgment was correct, would probably have been about 20 feet in diameter. Then the light would again increase its size to maybe 3/4 or 4/5 of the size of the entire object, and it would be that lavender color. This process of expansion and contraction of light continued, and my wife and I realized that it was matching the rhythm of our respiration rates. Wow! That's pretty cool. We became aware that the object was increasing its tempo. We saw one edge of the UFO raise so that it was no longer level with the tops of the trees. In the length of time that it took me to turn my head, the object had moved 10 miles out over Death Valley. I know it was 10 miles because we drove out underneath it. It's one way to find out. The thing that really amazed my wife and me was that it took off at that tremendous speed instantly, with no sound, no fire, no smoke, and all of the trees leaned with it, rather than being blasted backward. We looked the area over carefully and found no more small limbs and leaves on the ground than one would find under any grove of trees. The word that kept coming to me was that the object was impelled rather than propelled. It was drawn rather than pushed. If there would have been any force pushing it, it certainly would have blasted limbs and leaves off the trees. We drove out in the desert and stayed with the object for probably an hour and a half directly underneath it. When we first stopped the car, some substance that looked like whipped cream or heavy fog rolled out of the opening in its sides. It was probably not more than 300 feet above the ground, but it was completely hidden from view after it produced its own cloud of this substance. We knew it was there, though, so we drove back at a distance so that we could clearly see it sitting on top of its artificial cloud. Well, we were observing, I believe, was a phenomenon going on inside the object. I believe that the thing was breathing. I see no reason to change my thought on that matter. My wife and I both had the feeling that we were witnessing the ultimate in creation. The closer we came to the object, the more we were suffused with the feeling of reverence and beauty and humbleness. I'll tell you about another object we witnessed, and I will illustrate why I know there was no occupants inside it. This sighting occurred outside of Seligman, Arizona. We watched the object coming, then observed it change its course to come and hover not more than 15 feet above our Volkswagen. It seemed to me that it was just looking at us as if it were studying our little car. I jumped out with my Hasselblad camera and swung it up to take a picture. But before I could even touch the shutter, the UFO zipped right toward a little butte. I had a terrible sick feeling that anything so beautiful was going to crash and be destroyed. Instead of crashing, though, just before it touched the butte, it shot straight up. It didn't stop, it just changed direction. A right angle straight up and disappeared. No crew could have been in this craft and survived such a maneuver. They would have been mashed against the sides of the vehicle, and then pulled apart by the acceleration straight up. I do not believe that we observed a craft made by beings from some other planet. I believe that we were watching a living creature, a form of life that moved into our dimension. That'd be pretty cool to see. Different people throughout the years have said to me, Faye, you know a lot more than you are telling. Come on now, tell us the truth. Admit that you made contact with the alien inside the object. At least tell us they contacted you. But Brad, we were not contacted, and there were no occupants inside the object. We only had the most wonderful feeling of peace and harmony, and the knowledge that we were witnessing the beauty of the ultimate of creation. I firmly believe that UFOs are a form of life that come not from another planet, but from another dimension. I believe that they are probably all around us all the time, just outside of our own dimension. I can go with that. Oh, good. Right at the half-hour mark, I'm ready to start a new section. So we'll start that after the break.
3 minutes and 40 seconds. Is that enough time?
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you.
Of revolution, every ripple felt by the younger generation. Just rise and take your stand where you belong, cause it's awakening, replacing the false religion. Truth has spread like wildfire in the streets. Anything less than equal rights get deleted, cause all your consciousness we are seek. Open up your heart and let that inner voice speak. Capitalism and them economy. It's up to we, so open up your heart and let love lead the way. It's up to I and I.
And you're back. Maybe.
Thank you. I can feel that. I really can feel that the rest that I had has helped me. Thank you.
You're quite welcome. Okay. Good. I'm enjoying it. I can't believe what you just read about them being under this thing. And I mean, that was a hell of a story.
I agree. And I like the way that the angels worked out so that I ended that story just at the 4:30 mark. I loved it. Here's a new section called Trevor J. Constable and the Sky Critters. And Annette came home during the break, too. So we got to say our hellos. Sky Critters. Ooh, and they got this weird picture. Oh, my gosh. It's got this big old brick building like it would be the corner of a castle with all the arches right side by side, that, you know, behind the arches is a walkway, and then it's got the square tower type thing on the corner, and above it is this scary type looking picture, humongous. It covers the whole picture. All it's bigger than the size of this corner of a castle. And it has these cat-like eyes. It looks like a cat face that is kind of abstract. That's the best I can describe for you. Okay. In 1975, when Brad discussed the matter of living UFOs with another old friend, highly respected military and aviation historian, Trevor James Constable, TJ, said that biological life in the upper octave of terrestrial existence has been overlooked by too many UFO investigators who early on were in favor of the foregone conclusion that UFOs were vehicles from outer space. TJ handed Brad a stack of photos of UFOs that he had taken with a LEICA, capital G, and then a capital IR, 135 infrared film at f-3.5, 1/30. For you camera buffs, you'll probably get excited about that. I know nothing about it. These are plainly biological forms, he said. These are plasma-living organisms native to our atmosphere. As they appear in these photographs, they give one the impression of looking through the side of an aquarium. Oh, yeah, that's one way to put it. Constable continued. The daily etheric breathings of the Earth produce a barometric pressure wave twice daily, which formal science has never been able to explain. There is enough energy in these barometric waves to run the world's machines, if we can but find the transducer. The torque drive of the Earth itself is an inexhaustible life-positive energy source of staggering magnitude. That's what civilization depends on, making material substance spin. We see the disks in our skies manifesting these spinning motions over and over again, pressed down upon us in such profusion that one wonders how there can be any vestige of skepticism remaining. Wilhelm Reich has already shown that motors can be run directly from the cosmic life energy, or orgone, as he discovered and refined that energy. the characteristic of this coming epoch heralded by UFOs is that free primary energy will run the world. No one can put etheric force into a wire and sell it. No sheik can say that tomorrow etheric force is going to cost 4 times what it does today. No one can confine it within storage tanks and demand money for it. Everyone is going to have energy to do the world's work without pollution and without financial price. I wonder what that three-letter little twit would say about that. Before long, someone will uncover that all-important step, discovered by Wilhelm Reich, but not disclosed by him, by which etheric force can be transduced into existing electric motors or simple adaptations of them. Orgone and magnetism are cheek by jowl. The UFO evidence screams this at the world. The era of free primary energy is imminent, and its imminence is reinforced by the absolute necessity for its appearance. If anyone can find it, I know Walt Silva can. I just know he can. The UFO shows the feasibility and potential of etheric force in technological use. With etheric force comes not just a new technical epoch, but a cultural and educational change forced by the need to understand etheric energies as we now understand other energy forms. The price for this new technical epoch is a forced overhaul of our whole mode of existence. We will see the beginning of a reunion between science and religion as the cosmic energies, pervaded with life and themselves, the milieu of living beings, come into technical utility. Man will find the central parts of his own physical existence inseparably bound up with etheric energies, and he will be open to a widened understanding of himself and the cosmos that produced him. The ultimate consequence will be a new humanity. I just feel we're headed that way. I just have that feeling of wonderfulness. Constable handed Brad a photograph of a partially materialized UFO that Dr. James O. Woods had taken in the Mojave Desert in April 1958. According to TJ, whose own shadowed image appears in the lower right hand of this picture. I wonder if it's this picture I'm looking. Hold on. I don't see it. Okay. This photo provided basic keys to the propulsion system of this type of living UFO. The black dot on top of the two-tiered object, he said, was a lens for focusing primary energy from the sun. I'm looking at this picture. It's a head. It's kind of scary looking. The eyes are white and staring out at you. And he's got this smile on his face like, come here, I'm going to eat you. Oh, my gosh. He's got, and the headgear looks like one of those old Egyptian ones. The tall hat type thing. And in it, just resting on his eyebrows and between his eyebrows looks like a bat sitting there with its legs folded, touching each eyebrow and its body touching in between. And then the bat ears are up at the top. Kind of a scary looking picture. Let's see what it says. arithmetic entities are fallen angels, according to Persian and Chaldean traditions, who travel in high-tech vehicles and inhabit the space between Earth and the heavens. Today, they are mistaken for alien interstellar space travelers. Art by Ricardo Pustanio. No wonder it looks so scary. Okay, back to the book. Where did I leave it? Oh, the sun. Plasmic fields that appeared as white lobes whirled around the rim of the disk and created a plasma in the atmosphere that Dr. Woods had recorded with infrared film. A photograph taken by Constable captured a rather large space critter near Giant Rock, California, on May 17, 1958. It is such critters as this that account for so many UFO sightings, he said. I maintain that such atmospheric animal forms exist in an adjacent but invisible physical continuum. Normally, these creatures are invisible to human sight, but they occasionally drop into the visible spectrum as a result of far-reaching changes in the biosphere brought about by human activity. After many years of research, Constable came to the conclusion that it is the aeromantic powers that are trying to seize control of our planet. He believes that inner space, not outer space, is the invasion route chosen by the aeromantic powers. The choices we make, Constable says, and the extent to which we utilize balancing forces to neutralize the aeromantic attacks will bring us victory or defeat. According to Persian and Chaldean tradition, the Aramanes are fallen angels who, out of revenge for being expelled from heaven, continually torment the apex of God's creation, the human inhabitants of Earth. The old legends have it that the Aramanes decided to inhabit the Aramane-Abad, A-B-A-D, the space between the Earth and the fixed stars. Because from time to time, the aromatic entities have revealed themselves riding in etherically propelled vehicles that appear to represent a material technology far in advance of that possessed by humans. People have assumed that such UFOs are spacecraft from a scientifically superior extraterrestrial world. In addition, the aeromantic beings have devised contact encounters with ingenious human beings who can be used to serve certain ends in propagating the thought that the Space Brothers come from outer space, rather than being deceivers from a non-material dimension near at hand. You know what? I've been putting together a list of questions for our family out-of-towners, and I think this is a good question for them. Have you ever seen or encountered, what are they called? Aramanicentities, who are said to live between Earth and the stars. Oh, cool. I better save that. I don't want to lose my question. Saved. Yay! Boy, am I going to have a list of questions for them? We have them every, we have the two ladies every first Saturday of the month. Because Christy is the last Saturday of the month. Okay, yes, we have them now coming every first Saturday of the month. Judy and Barbara. And they're very interesting to listen to, y'all. They're on Say What, first Saturday of every month, and that's at 6 to 8 p.m. EST. And it's on our Cosmic Reality radio show station. Okay, now where was I? Constable decrees that the overall consequences of such deceptive contact encounters wherein humans are set upon by the Aramanic humanoids is that the world is led to believe that material craft and physical alien beings are involved. And if people are not convinced by the contactee, then he or she is labeled just another flying saucer nut. Maybe they need intervention. Either way, the world gets a lie overlaid with confusion and ridicule while the Aramanic humanoids depart from view. The Aramanic deceivers are everywhere, Constable warns, unrecognized and often aided by humans who don't know that the devil is indeed and well and coming to Earth within the lifetime of millions now living. One is always wise to test the spirits and attempt to determine if the counseling entity serves the dark side or the light side of the force. And caution should be doubled in reports of UFO encounters. For in Constable's opinion, the Aramanic messengers inject themselves into such events in order to sow confusion, disorientation, and distrust among UFO investigators. Humans are constantly being seduced into doing the work of the nether forces because they simply do not acknowledge that such forces exist, let alone recognize how they work into and upon Earth life. Incomprehension of spiritual forces and the institutionalized denigration of the spirit in formal education make humanity pitifully vulnerable in dehumanizing life negative and destructive trends, Constable says. The Aramanic intelligences confront humankind with a bewildering armory of advanced technical devices, transcendental abilities, and mind-bending powers. Armed only with mechanistic thought and an unbalanced technology, the human posture for meeting this stupendous and unavoidable event is both unstable and inadequate. Constable maintains that the hope of humankind lies in the expansion of human awareness. If man can be shown where the battlefield is, the nature of the terrain, and the ways in which he is already being assaulted in this inner war, then the right tactics and strategy can be brought to bear against inimical forces. Boy, I'm having trouble with my tongue. For centuries, the Aramanic entities have held as their goal the enslavement of humankind. If they are unopposed, they will overwhelm humanity and take evolution wholly under their control. Wholly, W-H-O-L-L-Y, entirely under their control. We must realize that in the struggle for mastery of Earth, we human beings and our souls are at once the goal of the battle and the battleground itself. Well, that's pretty interesting. I wasn't thinking of beings living between Earth and the stars who are going at us. Oh, good Lord, it seems like we are just the food for everybody. New section, Real Encounters with Orbs. One summer night in 1953, as 17-year-old Brad Steiger was driving home in his 1948 maroon Ford coupe, he was startled to see a greenish glowing orb of light bobbing right ahead of him, square in the middle of the country road at the end of a neighbor's lane. It appeared to be about the size of a volleyball or basketball. Oh my gosh, I turned the page. What the heck is this picture? It looks like a frickin' worm with a bunch of legs on its side. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12 legs on its side. Ball lightning, swamp gas, will-o'-the-wisps, even camera flares or other optical illusions. People have tried explaining strange lights for years without much success. And this art by Ricardo Pustanio. Jeez, I don't like looking at that while I'm trying to read. That takes up half the page. Okay. So he's seeing something that appeared about the size of a volleyball or basketball. Brad really didn't have time to hit the brakes in order to avoid striking the mysterious illuminated ball because it came right at him and passed right through the windshield. It remained for a couple of disconcerting moments at Brad's chest level in front of the steering wheel. Then it veered around him to pass out an open back window. Although the object had appeared to be a solid ball of some luminous substance, it had passed through the windshield of the Ford without causing the automobile or the driver any discernible damage. Brad was shaken by the encounter and had no idea what the thing was. The next day, describing the experience to some of his friends, he learned that three teenage girls claimed to have been chased home after encountering a glowing ball of light at the same place on the same country road. Incredibly, the glowing globe was waiting for Brad near the same clump of trees on the next two consecutive evenings. On each occasion, it seemed eager to demonstrate its ability to pass through solid matter without leaving any trace of its entrance or exit. After three nights of close encounters with the enigmatic glowing green light, Brad did not witness another until several years later while driving late at night. On that occasion, the light swerved away from his car and shot at great speed across an open, freshly planted cornfield. A study of perplexing phenomenon yielded information about manifestations of will-o'-the-wisps, swamp gas, and ball lightning. None of these theories seem to explain the remarkable faculties of the glowing green globe that could pass through an automobile's windshield without leaving any evidence of penetration. Boy, that'd be frustrating if you're trying to tell someone and you got no evidence whatsoever. It's just a story. Oh, here we are at the top of the hour, 5 o'clock. I just ended this section, and I'm ready to start a new section. We'll do that after the break.
5 and a half minutes.
Okay, thank you.
child of God, and that will never change. You had a dream, you misunderstood.
Just beautiful. Oh, so relaxing. Really. Wow. Thank you for playing that. I love it. I love it.
Me too.
Makes my eyes cry. I love it that much. And I get goosebumps.
I feel it's Gaia singing to me.
Yeah, I feel pretty close to that. I feel it's angels singing to me.
Well, that works too.
Yeah. Yeah, they both work. Okay, let's bring my eyes into focus and get my head back to the book. Phew. The Orb That Followed Her Home. Some years ago, we received a letter from an elderly woman who had a rather frightening encounter with such a glowing object in 1916. Mrs. B.K. was teaching at a rural school near Wellsburg, Iowa, and boarding with a farm family. One night in May, near the end of the school year, she was restless and unable to sleep. So even though the hour was very late, around 11, she got up, dressed, crept silently down the stairs, and walked out the door and went for a walk. Then, as she tells it in her own words, and this is what she's going to say, "It was a beautiful night, and the full moon was riding high in the sky. I felt quite exhilarated and not at all afraid. All the farm families in the neighborhood were fast asleep, so there was little chance of meeting anyone on the little-traveled dirt road. I was enjoying my walk so much that I didn't notice how far I had gone, but it must have been 2 or 3 miles. As I realized that I must start back, the sky became overcast, covering the full moon and making the night darker and darker. My mood changed to an eerie sort of fear, and I kept walking faster and faster. At last, I reached the crossroads near where I was staying. Then I suddenly turned my head and looked over my shoulder. There, just a few yards behind me, floating about 3 feet above the ground, was an orange-red ball or disc, following me at the same pace as I was walking. It glowed dully, but shed no light around it or on the ground. As soon as I saw it, it veered off to the side of the road, rose a bit, then sailed over the barbed wire fence and disappeared in some shrubbery on the other side. What a cowardly little ball. It was with great relief, that I reached the house and went back to bed. I did not want my landlady to know about my midnight walk, but finally my curiosity got the better of me, and I did tell her about what I had seen. She merely nodded and said, "We call them jack-o'-lanterns." From her response, it was obvious that lots of other folks had seen them, but I sensed that she didn't care to talk more about the subject, so I dropped it. I'd heard of such things as the will-o'-the-wisp, but I always pictured that as a rather formless white light, and this had been an orange-colored globe. There were no swamps or marshes around, so it couldn't have been a swamp gas. My father once said something vague about ball lightning, but if it had been that, it should have exploded. This strange ball of reddish light behaved as if it were intelligent, for it had been following me in a straight line. But as soon as it was discovered, it swerved aside and went into the bushes as if in hiding. And hadn't there been something unnatural about the sudden darkness? This experience remains among my unsolved mysteries. New section titled, "Are Orbs Ball Lightning?" I have trouble saying those two words because my teeth want to fall down in between the word ball and lightning. So please bear with me when I say it. Okay, ball lightning. The most often cited suspect for such encounters as ones above remains a mystery. On June 7, 2006, National Geographic News stated that in spite of around 10,000 written reports of observations of ball lightning, the phenomenon had thus far defied precise scientific explanation. ball lightning is most often described as a floating, glowing, round object, similar in size to a tennis ball or even a beach ball. The mysterious ball floats near the ground, sometimes rebounding off other objects and always defying the known laws of gravity. Although contact with the glowing orbs are usually not fatal, people have been killed by touching ball lightning, and there are reports of the objects melting through glass windows and burning through window screens. Notice that the reports state melting through glass, not passing through without leaving a sign of its sizzling passage. Graham K. Hubler, a physicist at the U.S. Naval Research Laboratory in Washington, D.C., told Brian Handwerk of National Geographic News, May 31, 2006, that ball lightning is a real physical phenomenon that's out there in nature, and we don't have the foggiest idea what it is. It's possible that there's some new physics in it that could be very profound. End of that. Here's a new section, the shining ones. What if such manifestations as these glowing balls of light should be intelligent entities? Or what if they should be the vehicle of transport for multidimensional beings? We have a folklore and a religion at least 2,000 years old that links these mysterious globes of light with the devas, the shining ones. Although Hinduism does not specifically refer to the devas as angelic beings, they do act in ways similar to angels, and they can play a protective role toward humans. And just as there are devas who dwell in the higher astral planes, there are fallen devas who live in the lower astral planes. Devas may also assist in humans' spiritual development and concern themselves with the fruitful growth of the earthly environment. The manipulation of glowing balls of light as a means of transportation may also be employed by angels and spirit guides. Indeed, the globes of light may be the form these benevolent beings assume before fully materializing in our dimension. As a word of caution, however, we must remind the reader that not-so-benevolent beings may also utilize orbs for more nefarious purposes. Throughout the centuries, men and women have encountered elves, fairies, huddle folk. Ooh, huddle folk? I never heard of that one. H-U-D-D-L-E-F-O-L-K. Or whatever one chooses to label our earthly companion species. Arriving in illuminated globes. Remember Glinda, the good witch in The Wizard of Oz, who soared and descended in a large ball of light? Other observers of the metaphysical scene theorize that the balls of light are themselves an intelligence that can shapeshift into the physical form most compatible with the level of understanding of each individual witness, appearing to some as an angel, to others as a diva, and to those of more conventional beliefs as a saint or a holy figure. And when they figure out how they're going to show themselves to us, that leads me to the thought, well, then they're reading what we're thinking. They're reading our, not just what we're thinking, because maybe we're not thinking that specific thing, but they know what thoughts we have had and are having. Invasion of my being there. Not sure I like it. But I don't have a choice. New section called Encounters with Orbs are on the increase. Very interesting. Are they on the increase or are they just being reported more these days? Paranormal researchers have taken notice that encounters with spheres of light have been on the increase in recent years. Balls of light have been reported moving above fields of wheat and corn, apparently responsible for the crop circles found there the next morning. Paranormal investigators have photographed orbs while recording phenomena in houses said to be haunted. And they aren't talking about dust motes or droplets of water captured by their digital cameras, but about glowing spheres that moved toward them. Skeptics attribute such manifestations to balls of plasma energy or natural phenomenon, but others are convinced that these objects are under the control of angels, spirit guides, nature spirits, or other multidimensional beings. I think some of them can be, yes. Energy, it's all energy. Consider, for example, the essential message, which may lie in the basic shape of the orbs moving about in haunted places. The mysterious discs darting across the skies all are most often reported as circular in form. In numerous instances, the UFO seems almost to have been Mandela-like, and like the Mandela, which is often used for purposes of meditation, has precipitated in the observer's state similar to that of trance. In his ego and archetype, Jungian analyst Edward E. Edinger discusses Rhoda D. Kellogg's studies of preschool art. Ms. Kellogg observed that the mandala or circle image appears to be the predominant one expressed by young children learning how to draw. Initially, a 2-year-old merely scribbles, but soon he seems to be attracted by the intersection of lines and begins to make crosses. The cross soon becomes enclosed by a circle, thus presenting us with the basic pattern of the mandala. As the child endeavors to replicate human figures, Ms. Kellogg noted, they first emerge as circles, contrary to all visual experience with the arms and legs being represented only as ray-like extensions of the circle. Edinger assesses Ms. Kellogg's studies as providing clear empirical data indicating that the young child experiences the human being as a round, mandala-like structure, and verifying in an impressive way the psychological truth of Plato's myth of the round man. Child therapist Edinger notes, often find the mandala an effective healing image in young children. All of this indicates that, symbolically speaking, the human psyche was originally round, whole, complete, in a state of oneness and self-sufficiency that is equivalent to deity itself. Out of the eyes of babes. It may be that the message of these orbs moving about our fields and forests, or these discs moving across our skies, is a call to humankind to return to that original state of wholeness. that sense of oneness with the cosmos. Surely, the holistic view, that which maintains that all life is one, and that each single cell maintains a signal link-up with every other cell, is becoming increasingly popular. Humankind is reawakening to the necessity of becoming truly and totally integrated with its environment. Contemporary men and women by the hundreds of thousands are becoming vitally interested in meditative practices which will permit them to regain even fleetingly that state of union for which humankind apparently feels so much nostalgia. New section called A Renowned Researcher Tells of Her Lifelong Encounter with Orbs. I need a drink. Burners today. Burners. Dr. P.M.H. Atwater grew up in the reclaimed deserts of southern Idaho and is totally... Wait a minute. My eyes are really giving me fits. Hold on. I need to put eye drops in. But I'll wait. Dr. P.M.H. Atwater grew up in the reclaimed deserts of southern Idaho and is today an accomplished and successful writer of many books and an internationally known researcher and lecturer on the near-death experience. She is also the author of Children of the Fifth World, A Guide to Coming Changes in Human Consciousness. As a child, she may have seen the orbs of the nature spirits as they really are. As PMH tells it, as a child, I could readily see, hear, and talk to other human souls, and I honestly believed that everyone else could too. But it was when I went outdoors that the fun really began. I never really saw little people, not ever, but I did see colored vortexes of swirling, pulsating energy that I played with and watched. It is strange now, looking back, but I never had any desire to give them names or to place them in any kind of human role. It simply was not necessary to me for them even to have human forms. It was always all right for them simply to be what they were, and for me to be what I was. We didn't have to be models of each other to communicate or to share life. I like that. We didn't have to be models of each other to communicate or to share life. I like that statement very much. I'm going to read it again. We didn't have to be models of each other to communicate or to share life. Amen. Perhaps I really shouldn't call them vortexes either. Perhaps the best description would be to call them energy masses, for that's exactly what they were, pure energy. They made little movements and sometimes big ones without the benefit of wind. They behaved in playful fashion, sometimes kicking up a little dust here and there, sometimes ducking under a leaf or parting the grass. The energy masses I saw spun when they moved, like miniature whirligigs. Whenever they would spin onto the palm of my outstretched hand, they really tickled, and I found that to be a lot of fun. They had colors, sounds, and odor. Their colors, though, were not as the ones I see in the regular world around me. No, their colors were more like shimmering, translucent colors that you could taste. Each little energy mass created its own sounds that I am at a total loss to describe. Everything was so natural, so complete. I understand exactly what she's saying there. I enjoyed my little friends whenever I could. They were not bigger than life things to me. They were simply another part of life. They were not separate, ever, but they were a part of my total existence. As I grew older, they did not disappear, but they did become less important to me. It was seeing other human souls, observing living numbers, and perceiving sounds that bounced like tiny cubes in the air that caused me trouble growing up. These things and others like them are what I quickly learned to be quiet about, for to talk about them became a sin. When I reached puberty and throughout my teen years, the spirit keepers became a very important part of my life. Without their total acceptance of me and the training I received from them, I would not have survived my teen years with an intact personality. Aww. In the February 28, 2013 issue of her newspaper, Dr. Atwater dealt with the question of orbs and made some very interesting observations. Orbs, or any form of plasma, are attached to and follow consciousness. Plasma is a perfect container for the deceased or whatever seems alien, guides or guardians or visitors, and are frequently seen at funerals or doorways in between the many worlds of spirit. Notice that I said plasma will respond to consciousness, yours, mine, anyone else's. So of course those who grieved a loved one's death often see the face of that loved one in an orb, or sense that he or she is the orb itself. Perhaps contact has been made, even after many years, and communication in some form begins. Known internationally for her extensive research on the near-death experience, Dr. Atwater observed near-death experiencers see lots of orbs. Young people going through puberty do too. Anyone involved in energetic, emotional displays, positive or negative, often produce orbs. When I crossed the United States, leaving Idaho to move to Virginia, alone, totally dedicated to my mission, with no sense of fear, I saw orbs following along on either side of my car. Small ones, but always there, every day, just out there, in the air, just there. I had no sense of beings or guides or anything other than the comfort of having orbs around me. Were they protecting me? I don't know. I had no reason or desire to imagine a purpose for them, nor did they assume any special shape. Orbs can simply exist as an outplay of our own consciousness. Sometimes that's enough. Oh my gosh, 5:30, I ended that section. Well, chapter, and I'm ready to start a new chapter. After the break.
4 minutes. 4 minutes.
Thank you. Oh, I love it. Thank you, angels.
Yeah. critic enemy. You create more problems than you got to remedy. You're misleading and deceive my people endlessly. And then you wonder why me never want you next to me. Your civilians are like slaves, like in servitude. And the only way you keep them is to keep them from the truth. While your institutions keep indoctrinate the youth. We hear you speak of hope and change, then you leave no proof, eh? Babylon, you're smart, now this is more than true. But when the people waken up, they'll come straight after you. There's no escaping from the plans we got set out for you. You see your men, women, and children coming after you, eh? Life with you's illusion, not reality. And for anyone who wants some peace, you name insanity. You subdue my people with stories and fantasies. False governments, false courts, false authorities in there. Society. There is no other that could claim on notoriety. With all your chemical concoctions of variety, what you really seek is for my people to go quietly. But what they're really getting ill from is your mind control. It has diminished our intelligence and numbed our souls. Manipulation of the masses is your only goal. You may have succeeded, but the difference is now we know. So what you gonna do without our energy? Cause now we're using it to make a brand new energy. Yeah, we infuse our meditation, our philosophies, learning to transcend beyond the realms of this reality, yeah. So Babylon, it's over now, it's time you go. When one foundation's a rotten, you can't go no more. So lift your eyes and set your sights upon that door. And get the out of our lives, don't come back no more.
I'm not sure why we had to hear that a second time, but that producer's finger slipped.
Well, it's good because it's given me energies for the finish.
Well, plus I love the message. It's the one people concept, you know, that seems to be trending today. You know, we're coming together. There's been a change. There's an energetic change. Maybe it's the 100th monkey, but something's changed.
Yeah, I agree.
One people. Mm-hmm. With a few left out.
I'm thinking unity and intervention.
People don't know what you're talking about. That was last night's show.
I was told that, well, my daughter, my youngest daughter, it was suggested to her, if I need an intervention, they're willing to give it to me. And they think I might need one. But I haven't figured out for what, so that's what I'm talking.
Well, because you read books like this and you talk dirty about Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, you must need an intervention if you don't love her, hon.
Oh, that's so true, yes. That piece of scum. See, I'm talking dirty about her.
Intervention, intervention.
For a few seconds, I believed it. I did. I thought, oh my gosh, maybe I do need one. I don't know I need one. Maybe I do. And people who need intervened, they don't usually know they need intervened, so I follow that category because I don't know I need one. And then I thought, oh, pfft. I don't need one. I finally got my shit together. So now I like to joke about it. So that's where I'm coming from. Okay, let's start this new chapter. Old gods from the sea or visitors from the stars? Stars or UFOs dive into the Mediterranean Sea. Oh, I saw a show about that recently. On January 28, 2012, a young couple was walking on the promenade near the beach of the ancient seaport Ashkelon, Israel, when they spotted two stars that were flickering in light above the Mediterranean Sea. According to the report that they submitted to the National UFO Reporting Center, the lights moved slowly west like they were floating. As they watched, they saw the color of the lights suddenly change to red, with a 3-second gap between each flicker of each object. The two objects continued to move to the west until one of them began to fall very slowly to the sea. There was no noise as the object struck the water, and its companion hovered motionless, still flickering, for several seconds until it began to move to the west. Two other objects appeared above the one on the sea. After several minutes, the witnesses said in their report, the three objects flew away at super high speed, thanks to Peter Davenport, National UFO Reporting Center. That's where they got the information. Okay, this is a new section. 5 bright orange disks over Little Gasparilla Island. Another 2012 report from the files of Peter Davenport recounts the sighting of 5 bright orange discs by a group watching evening fireworks on the beach of Little Gasparilla Island, a barrier island midway between Sarasota and Fort Myers on Florida's tropical southwest coast. I did like living on that west coast, and I lived just south of Sarasota in Venice. And just north of Port Charlotte and North Port and those cities, Punta Gorda. And I did like it. It was very pretty over there. It's very old over there. The old people tend to go on that side of the state, whereas the younger people come over here on the east side. When I moved over here, holy cow, the energies were vibrant and excited. Very good energies over here because of the young peoples. Oh boy, I did verse. Okay, back to the book. The discs or orbs, 4 in back and 1 in the front, moved north along the coastline into the clouds. Hundreds were in the crowd on the beach watching fireworks about 9 p.m., and they saw the objects coming up the island's shoreline. According to witnesses, the glowing orange discs moved up the shoreline at a steady pace. The witness who made the report to the National UFO Reporting Center said that they did have one of the objects on a cell phone camera. When you zoom into the thing, it is a bright orange with red along the edges that were very strange. A new section called A Light Brighter Than Venus appears to follow a cruise ship. A mutual UFO network, MUFON, Case Management System, CMS report carries that the account of a couple on a cruise ship on September 6, 2010, through the Alaskan Inside Passage aboard the MS Norwegian Pearl. It was about 9:30 p.m., begins the witness, and our ship was traveling at 22 knots with a compass bearing of about 338 degrees. Ahead of the ship and about 10 to 20 degrees off her port bow and above us, I noticed a bright light heading in a straight line along the side of the ship. It was coming directly toward the ship, but on a parallel, not an intercept course. The witness describes the light as being brighter than Venus, a dingy yellowish white with no flicker to it. He called his wife's attention to the object, and they observed that the slow-moving object progressed above and along the length of the ship and passed by our position over a period lasting about 5 minutes. The couple saw no signs of a strobe light or any navigation lights. It passed them by probably no less than 1,000 feet. After about 5 minutes, the slow-moving silent object faded from view. Then it reappeared in its full brightness at about the same position relative to the ship. This time, it kept exact pace with the ship, but it was now moving on an intercept course perpendicular to the ship. According to the witness, the mysterious object took 2 minutes to traverse a distance equal to the length of his thumb held at arm's length. At that point, he said, the yellowish-white object made a course deviation away from the ship before correcting once again in the opposite way so that it was again approaching. And that's the end of that. Well, I feel like they're leaving us hanging in the air here. All right. New section. Chinese-US Armada investigates underwater base near San Francisco. In mid-September 2012, you know, I've noticed, I hate saying, you know, I apologize for that, because if I'm telling you, you have no idea what's in my head, so you don't know. All right, so I can get over that now. I have noticed a lot of things have occurred in 2012, and we were always told, oh, 2012 is going to be it, something's going to happen in 2012, hell's going to break loose, yada, 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 be afraid of 2012. Well, I always looked at it with anticipation. I mean, if people are telling me doomsday with 2012, I'm thinking, ooh, how exciting. Because you don't believe the doomsday sayers. If they're saying it, it's not going to happen. So anyway, 2012 passed, and I didn't notice anything exciting. Nothing earth-shattering in my life happened in 2012. So I was kind of disappointed in 2012. But the more books I read, the more stories I hear about things like this happening in 2012. So I think 2012 was more exciting than I have any idea about. Okay, so I deviated on that one. In mid-September 2012, Gordon Duff, senior editor of Veterans Today, reported on a classified memo which had first been confirmed, then denied, that detailed an account of a combined fleet operation of Chinese and U.S. Navy vessels gathering off the U.S. coast near San Francisco to confront extraterrestrial craft operating from underwater bases. Oh, hey, isn't this the one that, what's her name? Nancy was on her show. Why can't I think of her name? She reported it. She was all in a dither, and she came into WSR, and she was telling Dave all about all of us in there about this sighting, the Chinese and the U.S. Navy vessels off the U.S. coast near San Francisco saw this extraterrestrial craft operating from underwater bases. Oh, what's her name? Carrie Cassidy. That's who it was. She came tearing into WSR, try to contact Dave and talk to him about it. And I'm telling you, I have never seen this woman this excited in the whole time I've known of her. But she was so excited, she almost messed her pants. I mean, maybe she did, because that's how excited she was. But I'm finding this very interesting to read this in this book now. So let's see what they have to say. I remember this event, so let's see what they have to say. Duff credited, oh, look at this. I could have read this a little further and I would have known it. Duff credited Carrie Cassidy of Project Camelot Whistleblower Radio as an early source for the rumored assemblage of the multinational military force. See? Told you it was Carrie Cassidy. The rumors flying around the event included the following. Number one, extraterrestrial craft were operating from underwater bases. Number two, in order to deal with the extraterrestrial threat, advanced U.S. suborbital weapons platforms had been deployed from Vandenberg Air Force Base. She said that too. Number three, the process of UFO tracking was now employing nanotechnology microscopic sensors to detect such eventualities as distortions in time. I wish I had that. Of course, I don't know if Dave was taping at that time. I bet he wasn't. I bet he was. No, he says, Dolly, I didn't get it on tape. She was talking in the chat room. Then he brought her on the air. Oh, okay. But he wasn't taping at the time. Yeah, I remember, Dave. It was exciting. Of course, we all thought she was crazy, but it was still exciting, yes. I'm having this memory with Dave, y'all. So you're joining in this memory we have. The reasons for the formation of the Chinese U.S. Armada were the conclusions of high-ranking military officers that the extraterrestrial opposition was extremely aggressive and unfriendly, and that the threat represented a clear and present danger to the topside residents of Earth. China, so said the rumors, was forced to cover for a more extensive U.S. presence in confronting the extraterrestrial threat because the U.S. Navy had developed a large number of its vessels, had deployed a large number of its vessels to the Persian Gulf, echoing a warning that attempts to seek confirmations or to directly verify these multinational operations could lead to fatal consequences. Gordon Duff gave the rumors a 70% reliability grade. Ha! Poor Carrie, we were saying she was nuts. Was she okay? You know, we're thinking, oh my gosh, this lady's crazy. So she kept saying, look on, listen to the TV, listen to the radios. They're not saying anything, but this is happening. Bless her heart. Well, you know how they like to discredit people who are seeing real truths. And I was right there with them. Shame on me. I apologize, Carrie Cassidy. I sincerely apologize for not believing you that day. But I did think something exciting was happening because you were that excited. I just didn't know what. Okay. New section. Researchers state undersea alien bases are found in oceans worldwide. Our contemporary mysteries of the sea contain innumerable accounts of mysterious lights in the skies, UFOs in parentheses, as well as unidentified submersible objects cruising our oceans, seacoasts, and large bodies of inland waters. The USO's apparently affinity for water has long been noted by ufologists and flying saucer buffs. Perhaps, I'm trying to see the time. Oh, perhaps the UFO enigma might be traced to the inner space of our seas rather than the outer space of our solar system. There is no question that claims of mysterious underwater bases have been circulating since before and after pilot Kenneth Arnold, who, while flying near Mount Rainier on June 24, 1947, sighted the flying saucers that signaled the beginning of the modern era of the UFO mystery. On July 7, just 2 days after the alleged crash of an alien space vehicle near Roswell, New Mexico, two teenagers walking on the beach at San Rafael, California, were astonished to see an unusual craft emerge from the ocean. According to writer-researcher Preston Dennett, the teenagers watched as a flat, glistening object flew for a short distance, then dove back into the water 400 yards from shore. Dennett, who has been researching underwater UFO bases since the late 1980s, reports in Fate, February 2006, that in August 1947, steamers and other sea traffic going into and out of San Francisco Bay encountered a mysterious object that was large enough to earn descriptions of being an undersea mountain, a reef, or a submarine mountain, before it decided to leave the Golden Gate behind and move out to sea. I love it. Dennett documents an early morning sighting near Playa del Rey on November 6, 1957, in which three motorists driving along the Pacific Coast Highway were startled to see a large egg-shaped object enveloped in a blue haze descend on the beach only a few yards away. The witnesses, Richard Kehoe, Ronald Burke, and Joe Thomas, got out of their cars and warily approached the strange craft. As they drew nearer, they saw two strange-looking occupants disembarking from the UFO. According to the three witnesses' reports, the UFO nauts had yellowish-green skin and wore black leather pants, white belts, and light-colored jerseys. The strange beings walked up to the three men and began to attempt to converse with them. The men later said that the occupants seemed to be trying to ask them questions, but the language in which they spoke was completely unintelligible to them, and they could not recognize it as a language with which they had any familiarity. After a few minutes, the occupants of the craft walked back to their craft in obvious disappointment with their failure to communicate. Aww. After entering the egg-shaped vehicle, they quickly took off and seemingly within seconds had accelerated out of sight. Aww. That was in when? 1957. When did Mork from Ork come on TV with his egg-shaped ship? I wonder if they took that from this report. I can't remember when more came in. I think my kids were born by then, so it had to be after the 50s, because Nett was born in 69. I don't know. I can't figure it out. That same day at 3:50 p.m., writes Dennett, author of UFOs Over California, A True History of Extraterrestrial Encounters in the Golden State, an officer and 12 airmen from an Air Force detachment in nearby Long Beach observed six saucer-shaped objects zooming across the sky. 2 hours later, officers at Los Alamitos Naval Air Station reported seeing numerous objects crisscrossing the sky. At the same time, police stations in Long Beach received more than 100 calls from residents reporting UFOs. Pretty nifty. So, according to my clock, we have 2 minutes and I'm ready to start a new section. So, we'll start that next week. And this week, right now, Nancy, you want to tell people about the 5G, the new 5G station?
Oh, thank you. Yes, we've started up a new station, so to speak. It's Cosmic Reality, but it's Radio 5G, and it's standing by itself because it'll probably be attacked. And I don't want all my you know, pieces on the table when it does. But so we had the premiere show today. We didn't really advertise it because we weren't sure what was going to happen, because it was Mark Steele from Britain, who is a human, the human race's hero right now. And he, anytime I had heard him prior to that, the signal was not really very good from Great Britain. So I get him on, and I'm going like, wow, this signal is amazing. Amazing signal, right? And I'm on with Michael Henry Dunn, who's doing he's really leading the show. And the show itself was absolutely amazing, because he's talking all the bad stuff, even told me stuff I didn't even know about
5G. Oh, no.
Yeah, about 5G. And then we got him focused on he can't talk about his court case because they've actually arrested him, tried him, and he's going to go to jail if the appeal doesn't work. Yeah, over 5G, because what he's saying is making people afraid. He's a terrorist. That's the charges he was brought up on.
Because he's telling the truth.
Because he's telling the truth. That happens to be scary as hell.
Yeah. Scary Mona.
Yeah, yeah. But then he went into a conversation that was extremely spiritual. And that he feels he has a mission, and that he says, the bottom line here is God never loses. It was an astounding show. But what I found really ironic was the fact that when I got off of the show and I went over to Facebook, Facebook was not working in Great Britain, nor is it working in the Northeast, or was, and also over where Michael Henry is. And so essentially the reason we had such an enormously great signal was because nobody was on Facebook. Millions of people were not taking the bandwidth.
Oh.
So thank you, whoever did that. Okay, we got to go. Oh, we're going to do a replay of Dolly Shares, I'm assuming.
We are? Oh, Dolly Shares. I forgot all about it. Oh, man. Oh, no. I guess we are, Nancy. I apologize.
Good thing I have it ready. It's you talking about Derek and Derek's healing.
Oh, good. I like that.
Alrighty. I guess you better say bye-bye, but wait a second, bye-bye. Because, don't do it yet, because I don't know where I put your outro. I'm on the wrong page. Oh, goodness. Okay, here we go. Go ahead. You can say it. Go ahead. Do it.
Okay. Bye-bye.